Coming up on the program today, a double dose of macroeconomic policy, currency manipulation, and the costs of regulation. We'll make it listenable, I promise. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Tuesday, the 31st day of January. Good as always to have you with us, everybody. Trade, as we all know, was a cornerstone of President Trump's campaign last year. And to that end, an item from the Financial Times today in which the president repeated his inaccurate claims that China is artificially devaluing its currency, and in which, furthermore, the president's key trade advisor said the euro is grossly undervalued, too, and that the White House believes Germany is using it to, and this is a quote, exploit its trading relationship with the United States. Charges of currency manipulation get murky in a hurry, but how much a euro or yuan or a dollar is worth goes to the very heart of President Trump's trade strategy. So Marketplace's Sabri Benishour has a little primer for us.
In an open and global economy, countries' currencies rise and fall. The values change like the weather. And that matters. Lee Brandstetter is a fellow at the Peterson Institute.
When a country's currency falls, that has the effect of making goods produced inside that country cheaper on foreign markets.
Trump cares about countries' currencies falling because they make U.S. exports uncompetitive and or expensive by comparison. Now, some countries, they're not supposed to do this, but sometimes they do, will intentionally push their currencies down. The real trick is figuring out when a country is doing this on purpose and when it's not.
Currency manipulation ultimately and to a significant extent lies in the eyes of the beholder.
Ishwar Prasad is senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. Just because a currency goes up or down does not mean that a country meant for that to happen. For example, Japan has had a lot of economic problems for years now, so it's tried to lower interest rates and expand the money supply. Lee Brandstetter again.
A side effect of expansionary monetary policy is that a nation's currency will tend to weaken. But the weakening of the currency was not the goal of Bank of Japan policy, and that has been crystal clear.
Then there's Germany. Trump advisor Peter Navarro has said Germany is unfairly benefiting from the euro being weak.
It's missing the point because Germany itself does not have any control over the euro. The policy is set by the European Central Bank.
Boris Schlossberg is with BK Asset Management. Saying Germany is unfairly benefiting from a weak euro is like saying California unfairly benefits from a weak dollar. Germany has actually lobbied against a weaker euro. In 2015, the Treasury set up a test to figure out if countries were manipulating their currencies or not. It found that neither Germany, nor Japan, nor China were doing so. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
One more item from the 2016 Trump campaign to set up our off lead today. One of the promises the president made when he was running was that he was going to bring jobs back to coal country. Coal companies, as Scott Tong has reported for us in depth, have been struggling with layoffs and bankruptcies brought about by what coal interests call excessive regulation, but also by what capitalism calls market forces, including the cheap and getting cheaper cost of natural gas. Congressional Republicans said today that they would respond with a push to trim or loosen some of those regulations on coal. Whether that's going to be enough to overcome the market dynamic is as yet unclear. Marketplace's Mark Garrison has that story.
Coal's got a lot of problems, chief among them tough competition in an energy sector that is very different than it was a decade ago. As Adele Morris at the Brookings Institution points out, even if you wipe out all the rules coal companies hate,
that's not going to repeal the price of natural gas.
The stuff is dirt cheap. Solar and wind are increasing market share, too. Coal once provided half America's electricity. These days, just a third. There's another key element of coal's nightmare. In recent years, companies bet big that they could sell coal abroad. Hasn't panned out, explains John Larson at Rhodium Group.
China's growth has slowed down considerably, as has India and Europe.
In this environment, rolling back regulation can only do so much. Sarah Ladislaw follows energy policy at the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
It does take a little bit of the pressure off, but absent some sort of incentives that really favor coal, it's really hard for them to be able to get some momentum to really make them an engine of job creation or economic growth.
And lighter regulations don't necessarily mean more jobs swinging pickaxes, says Amy Myers Jaffe at UC Davis.
Coal's response to the competition from natural gas is going to be to automate. They're using robots, self-driving trucks. For the coal industry to be competitive, it's not going to be adding jobs.
Coal's new friends in Washington don't wipe out its old economic troubles. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
Lackluster day in equities this Tuesday. A little earnings malaise, it seems. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. According to the Census Bureau, nearly a quarter of all the people of Iranian ancestry in the United States live in Los Angeles. The government puts the number at around 120,000 in metro L.A. Tehrangeles, some people call it. Think about it. It's a well-established community, relatively well-off, and as of last Friday, trying to understand what President Trump's travel ban means for them. Marketplace's Adrian Hill has been reporting the story for us. Hey, Adrian.
Hey, Kai.
So give me a sense of how the Iranian-American community, at least here in Los Angeles, is responding.
I think like a lot of immigrant communities affected by this ban, with some amount of fear, just not knowing what's going to happen next, trying to figure out what it means for them, for their family, for their friends. I reached out to a lot of people, and a lot of them didn't want to talk to me. But Bijan Khalili did. He owns a Persian bookstore here in L.A. He's owned it for 36 years. Yeah. He also runs a hotline for Iranians in L.A. that's kind of like 411 for the community.
And we had tremendous phone calls for the immigrant attorneys for the last 2-3 days to get phone calls or contact information of immigrant attorneys, Iranian immigrant attorneys, to be able to talk over their situation and the family situation.
Yeah, I bet. I mean, immigration lawyers are the hot commodity.
They're busy right now.
This past weekend. But other than that, right, other than work for the attorneys, what do we know about how and I guess if, right, the travel ban is going to impact, you know, entrepreneurs in this country and businesses, you know, here?
So still really early days. And I think if is the right word. We don't know.
Right.
We don't know a lot. But there are in Los Angeles's Iranian community, like many immigrant communities, people doing import-export business. And this is this really interesting thing I discovered. And we're talking small and mid-sized businesses here, not the Walmarts of the world.
Yep.
But these business people need personal connections to trust that when they send $20,000 to somebody, they're going to send goods back. They need these personal connections to do business. There's this professor emeritus at UCLA named Ivan Light, and he studied some Iranian-born entrepreneurs here in LA, and he found this really interesting thing.
What we found is that they spent a lot of time going abroad to trade fairs, and when they went to the trade fairs, they met people, often not Iranians, but people of different nationalities with whom they wanted to trade.
Now, so these trade fairs are basically the way that many Iranian entrepreneurs were finding people to do business with.
This is an oversimplification, but it's like a handshake deal, right? You want to look the person in the eye to whom you're going to send your money.
You want to know this person at some personal level. And again, remember, for years and years, these, you know, Iranian, they couldn't do business with the home country, right?
Right.
So they have to find people in other countries to do business with. And you can see why this might be a problem.
Yeah, no, you totally can. Let me back you up for a minute, though, and ask the general tone question, right? And how what is coming out of Washington and the White House really is and has changed things for Iranian-American business people.
So I asked that to the bookstore owner, Bijan Khalili.
I never had any problem with my fellow Americans to bother me or to disturb my business or, you know, always they supporting the culture.
And he says the protests he's seen in response to this executive order have really given him some hope.
And it shows that Americans really support the other people from other countries. And this is a very good sign, shows still the humanity is not dead.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. What was great is he said fellow Americans there. Like
yeah.
It just kind of happened. Adrian Hill, reporting on the Iranian-American business community here in L.A. and more broadly the country. Thanks.
Thanks, Kat.
Here's a not-so-random number for you. 19,939,019,834,828.89. That is denominated in dollars and cents. It's the total outstanding national debt as of the close of business last Friday. And I mentioned it so I could say this. We've got a new podcast going, me and Molly Wood. It's called Make Me Smart. Molly Wood and me, I guess I should say. The idea being that we're all trying to understand what's going on in this economy and in this country a little bit better, which gets me to saying this. Hey, Molly.
Hey, Kai.
All right. So as promised, one of the things we're doing with this podcast is taking questions from listeners, the things they want to be made smart about. What do we got?
Yeah, the questions are, frankly, smarter than we are in some cases. First up, we have this one from Chris Miller. He wrote in via our website, marketplace.org/makemesmart. You can do that, too.
Yep.
And he asked us, where does the national debt and deficit fit into the next 4 years? And more importantly, when do we need to worry? Mm-hmm. Is it at 200% of GDP, maybe 300%?
Right. So as I said up on top, the debt is almost $20 trillion. It's a little bit more than 100% of GDP. Mm-hmm. But this is a three-part question, right? The first is deficit or debt. Deficit is the budget deficit that the government runs every single fiscal year. How much more they/we as taxpayers spend than we take in. And the debt is the accumulation of that deficit over the years, right? So that's the first part mm-hmm. of that question. And it matters because people get them confused all the time. And the implications are really profound, depending on which one you're talking about. So that's why that matters.
And then the second part of that is essentially what would happen to either of these under President Trump. And it, at least in the short term, sounds like there's a chance that both of those could increase dramatically, no?
Yeah, that's totally true, because what the president campaigned on and what he talked about a lot was a big infrastructure program to pick just one. Now, it's going to be a public-private partnership, and it's not going to be the whole trillion-dollar thing. But the fact is that the president has big spending plans. Congress and the president have big tax-cutting plans. And when you do that, when you spend more than you take in and then cut the amount that you take in, well, deficits will grow and debt will grow over time, because that's the way it works.
And now, although it does not work that way in your home, there is debate among economists and politicians about how much it matters.
Right. So here's the deal. The degree to which you need to worry about debt and deficit is directly related to how much the economy is growing and what the underlying economic fundamentals are. And as we learned, I guess it was last week, right? The economy is growing 1.6% a year for 2016, which is not a great rate. It's not the larger long-term average of 3%. But when the economy is growing, you can sustain debt and deficits in a larger amount than you can when the economy is not growing or stuck, which is why it'll be less tricky for Republicans and President Trump to raise that number in the short term anyway.
Yeah, similar to your household. If you know that you're going to have more money coming in, it's okay to spend a little more.
Yeah.
But you don't want to get yourself in trouble with your credit card if you know you're not going to get a big tax return.
Right. The other part of this, by the way, is the whole government run like a business thing, because businesses can't generally survive spending money the way the government spends money. And so this whole conversation we're having now about a businessman as president misses that key indicator, which is governments are not businesses, nor should they be run as such.
That's what we have a podcast for.
It is called, man, that was a good segue. It is called Make Me Smart. It's me and Molly. Drops Tuesday afternoons.
And today's episode, which you'll hear a little later this afternoon, has got, I thought, a really fascinating interview with the CEO of an artificial intelligence company, which has been a big part of the ongoing conversation about jobs in America and automation. And then just a part of a remarkable interview that Kai did with the legendary TV producer Norman Lear.
Check it out, would you? Coming up,
their services were basically illegal in a lot of cities around the world.
Changing the world, whether it wants to be changed or not. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's off 107 points today, about a half percent, 19,864. The NASDAQ gained a point, basically unchanged, 56.14. The S&P 500 off 2 points, pretty much unchanged, 22.78. As we mentioned, Republicans in Congress are looking to roll back regulations on the coal industry. Markets didn't care. Coal producer Peabody Energy dug up 8.5% today. Westmoreland Coal down 0.6%. Console Energy slipped 7.4% today. After the coal and mining numbers, let's flip the switch onto some other forms of energy, shall we? First Solar warmed up about 0.5%. SunPower rose 3.4%. Goldwind delivered 0.4%. They make wind turbines. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.46%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Hey, everybody. Molly here.
It's Kai, but you already knew that.
You did. But we have something that we would like to tell you together.
We are doing a new podcast. It's called Make Me Smart, about the things we want to know more about but don't always have time to dig into on this daily program.
Yeah, and it's about you, too, the things that you want to know more about and the things that you're an expert on. We'd like to have you on the show, too.
And mostly it's me and Molly having fun. Check us out at marketplace.org/makemesmart. There's lots more info there.
And please subscribe on iTunes or wherever you podcast.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. American companies with international operations are in kind of a tough spot right now. A lot of them are facing pressure to respond to the visa restrictions out from the Trump administration, while at the same time trying to avoid drawing the ire of the president and his Twitter feed. Pressures most keenly felt at the moment by companies operating in Mexico, as Marketplace's Kimberly Adams reports.
President Trump has been clear. He says he will bring back industrial and manufacturing jobs from Mexico, and he'll be happy to call out companies like Carrier and Ford to prevent them from expanding south of the border. Salvador Contreras teaches economics at the University of Texas, Rio Grande Valley. He says many companies are just trying to conduct business as usual.
What I suspect is going to happen is they're going to continue to operate steady as we go while they get better clarification.
But some Mexicans who work the assembly lines at these factories, called maquiladoras, are worried about Trump's plans. Viviana Valenzuela makes plastic dishes in Nogales, Mexico, that are also exported to the U.S.
Among the employees, we talk and make comments, and it's logical. We're all bothered by what he's doing and what he wants to do to the Mexicans.
Trump promises to renegotiate trade deals like NAFTA to get better deals for American workers and has indicated he's open to taxing goods coming from Mexico to help pay for a border wall. Here's Press Secretary Sean Spicer talking with reporters on a recent flight.
If you think about what a border tax on imports from countries like Mexico that we have a huge trade deficit does, that's really going to provide the funding.
That's one idea the Trump administration is floating. It's unlikely, though, American companies will pack up shop and leave Mexico anytime soon.
You can't just, you know, turn off the lights and walk away.
That's Professor Contreras at the University of Texas again.
I mean, these are, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars investments in infrastructure and facilities and training people to produce the goods and services that they produce.
Which is why another factory worker in Nogales, Jose Antunes, isn't worried about his job at a tampon factory.
A majority of the businesses that come from the United States or other countries, what they look for is stability and ways to save money. And in this aspect, I think we're fine.
Not to mention that pay at these factories is still a fraction of what it is in the U.S. And the Mexican peso hasn't been doing so well against the dollar since Trump's election. That could make it even cheaper for American companies to stay put, even with a tax. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Kimberly's reporting down on the border was supported by the International Women's Media Foundation's Adelante Reporting Initiative. Nearly all of the clothing sold in these United States is imported, and any given article can pass through a lot of hands. The fibers coming from one country, getting turned into fabric in another, and sewn together in yet a third before ending up on store shelves here. So with the Trump administration floating the idea of 20% border taxes on imports, what is that going to mean for the clothes on our backs? Marketplace's Mariel Segarra has that.
Azam Khawaja is standing behind the cash register at AK Fabrics, his wholesale fabric store in New York City's garment district. Brightly colored textiles, many of them made overseas in countries like China and Mexico, hang from racks lining the walls. Khawaja says tariffs on imports would hurt his business.
the price is going to go up, and we have to pass it to consumers, and a lot of people, they're not happy about it.
Those consumers are designers and clothing makers like Karen Fleisch, who's standing outside the store where she's been shopping for 30 years. She says she'll be forced to pass those costs on to her customers.
I got overhead and I got to eat.
She worries some customers won't be willing to pay the higher prices.
I used to sell a dress to somebody and used to cost them maybe $500. Now it's going to cost them $800.
It's not just designer dresses that would cost more under the tariff plan. Almost all of the everyday clothes you'd buy at a retailer, jeans, t-shirts, underwear, are made overseas. Gianluca Clementi is a professor at New York University's Stern School of Business.
Those are going to have a higher price, and that is going to put a dent on the wallet of American consumers and also on the bottom line of American companies.
Trump says the point of renegotiating U.S. trade deals is to bring manufacturing jobs back to the United States. Clementi says for the apparel industry, tariffs won't accomplish that, in part because overseas labor will still be cheaper.
A 20% tariff wouldn't even get close to close the gap.
Tasha Lewis, who teaches fashion design management at Cornell, says the United States also wouldn't be able to scale up its production to meet demand.
We don't have a lot of infrastructure currently that could handle the volume of what we might want to sell in retail stores.
Not the kind of news consumers or retailers want to hear just a few weeks ahead of the big spring shopping season. In New York, I'm Marielle Segarra for Marketplace.
It hasn't taken very long at all for Uber and Airbnb to go from, wait, what now? To household names. These startups that could have become tech giants playing on the national and international scale and in politics as well. Brad Stone writes about the start and rise of those companies and others in his new book. It's called The Upstarts. Brad, thanks for coming on.
Thank you, Kai.
I want to start with the guys who are running these companies. Travis Kalanick at Uber and Brian Chesky at Airbnb. Kalanick, as anybody who's interacted with him and interviewed him or, in fact, watched any of his presentations or performances knows, he's abrasive. I think that would be fair. Brian Chesky is capable but really, really full of himself. Where do they fall on the Steve Jobs meter of being able to work miraculous things? You know what I mean?
You know, I don't think we're ready to put them in the visionary category yet. And I actually make the argument that this set of founders needed something different than the last set. You know, Bill Gates and Mark Zuckerberg, we think of them as somewhat introverted, you know, not great communicators, mm-hmm. actually, although, of course, Zuckerberg has learned.
Yeah, he's getting it.
But Travis and Brian, you know, they needed to be storytellers. And like, their services were basically illegal in a lot of cities around the world. And so they needed to be politicians, I think. You know, Steve Jobs was not a politician, right? He often said the wrong thing. I think Travis and Brian both had to get very adept at weaving together coalitions of their customers, because let's face it, people love these companies yeah. by and large, and then using it to combat the incumbent industries like taxis and hotels.
Let me pivot you to the sort of events of the week, Brad, if I could, and specifically some of the problems that Uber's having just public relations-wise after the protests at the airport this past weekend and the Delete Uber campaign and all of that. Travis Kalanick is actually on the president's business advisory team.
And he I think, has suffered for that. And in a way that the other members of that team, the CEOs of IBM and Disney and Nike, have not. And you know, I don't really – there's not a lot of rationality to why they're being targeted by the Delete Uber campaign. I mean, all the car services in New York were servicing JFK during that hour-long strike mm-hmm. last week. But, you know, there's ill will that's been built up. They haven't navigated it particularly, you know, skillfully. I mean, Lyft made a $1 million donation to the ACLU, mm-hmm. and Uber, you know, was – they opposed the president's executive order, but they didn't communicate it as well, and now he's left with a big problem.
And here you have it. I'm just looking down, actually, at the cover of The Upstarts, and right underneath your name, it says author of the national bestseller, The Everything Store, which is, of course, about Amazon. We had you on the show about that, and Jeff Bezos. Bezos and Amazon are suing the president over this executive order. Other companies are having to do some very quick and deft strategic planning. Companies in this environment are finding the way a little tricky.
I mean, Kai, the immigration order is like a direct rebuke to the way Silicon Valley conducts business. Not only does it get all this entrepreneurial energy from immigrants, and then let's face it, these companies are blue state companies. So the employees of Google and Microsoft and Facebook are up in arms. And so we're seeing one by one all these companies reacting and you know, really doing what they can, in Amazon's case, throwing up a legal challenge to the order.
Brad Stone is the author most recently of a book called The Upstarts. It's about Uber and Airbnb and the new Silicon Valley companies that are changing the world. As I said, has also written about Amazon and Jeff Bezos and a bunch of other stuff at Bloomberg. Brad, thanks very much.
Thank you, Kai.
This final note on the way out today, in which reports of Apple's demise turn out to have been somewhat exaggerated. The company reported profits after the bell today. It sold 78 million iPhones in the 3 months ended New Year's Eve. Net income, that is to say profit, almost $18 billion. Its cash position, money in the bank, $246 billion American dollars. Speaking of which, printing money, by the way, which is what that is. The Fed announces its decision on interest rates tomorrow. That is going to be interesting to watch. All right, we got to go. The Dow off 107 today, a half percent, 19,864 on the blue chips. NASDAQ basically flat. The S&P 500 down 2 points. Tommy Andres and Raghu Manavalan are the producers on our elections desk. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our wealth and poverty desk. Our digital team includes Nishad Kerr, Sarah Menendez, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.